Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2014. Lecture 8, delivered on February 11, 2014. The title of this lecture is Risk and Return.
Today, Risk and Return. Now, I'm going to do a few last ratios with you and just talk about them for a minute or two before we go on to the main topic of the lecture today. I spend more time on the ratios than I probably should, but they are useful to know. Now, I'm going to turn off the house lights here in just a moment, so bear with me. Well, I don't need that one. And as I said, your ratio formulas are on a sheet on ReggieNet for you. You may bring a blank copy of that to your quiz or an exam. And also, the financials of Limited Brands is on the website, too, what we're working from here. So just a few last ones. I've gone through profitability formulas, although I should mention the dividend ratio and the plowback ratio. In other words, what percentages of each of those are going to is a company committing on behalf of the shareholders? In other words, how much of their earnings do they give back to the shareholders as dividends, and how much of their earnings do they commit back to the company to grow the company and hopefully grow the stock through capital gains in the plowback? And one thing is, I don't have the limiteds, if I'm not mistaken, I don't have the limiteds dividends. Well, let me check here. I don't have a dividend number for the limited, so I can't do the dividend and the plowback ratios, but they're fairly straightforward anyway. A couple of ratios that I do want to bring up to you here just briefly for a few moments. One is, there are two debt ratios. I already brought up one of them, the times interest earned debt ratio, which is just take your EBIT, in other words, your operating income, and divide it by the interest. And what you'll get from that will be how many times over they can pay their interest with the money that is available to pay the interest expenses. That obviously has to be above one, or they're in one or above, or they're in default. The farther above one it gets, the less they're using debt in their capital structure. Now, I think I'll do it on Thursday. I'm going to show you something called the gains to leverage, which shows how using debt multiplies the return on equity. But it is at the risk, the more debt you take on, obviously, the less you will want volatility in your operating income, because you don't want your operating income dipping below what you owe in interest payments. But anyway, that's down the road a day. The debt to total assets ratio. Debt, and I'm going to point out on the limited's financial statements here. Here is your, on the balance sheet, you look long-term debt. Traditionally, most analysts will say use that number as your total debt. However, sometimes you'll look up here and you'll see that there is something that is real debt, but it's hidden. It's not hidden. It is shuttled up here to the current liabilities, like a current portion of long-term debt. If there's a current portion of long-term debt, which you see here, but it's zero in 2013, you would want to add that in. Also, long-term debt, sometimes you'll see that broken down into bonds and notes. So make sure that you add together both of those kinds of long-term debt. for the debt to total assets ratio. Now, in this case, just to quickly run through the numbers for the limited, for the purpose of just saying a little bit about it. Your long-term debt for 2013 was 44, well, let's turn on the calculator, 4473 divided by total assets of 6019. Is that right? 44, oh, I was just, I don't know what, why I said 3. Okay, let's try that. Okay. Holy cow. Really? What do you get? That's a percentage, by the way. 74.38%. What is it over? It's over total assets. So you're going to get a percentage. In other words, what percent of their total assets is debt? And if you look at the limited, that is heavy leverage. I mean, that's almost 75%. Three-fourths of that company is debt. And then a fourth of it would be equity. So that, well, you know, one way or the other, we'll talk about optimal capital structure, how much debt, how much equity is best for a company later in the course. But I will tell you right now, that's a little bit surprising. Usually you'll see it somewhere 30%, 40%. Some companies you see almost no debt in the capital structure, which is not, that's just the policy of the company, perhaps not the best policy. But when I see 75%, almost three-fourths of the company is debt, that'll make my back leg go up and down, because you understand that the debt carries interest payments. Those have to be paid with the operating income. You know, you go down that line. So as your sales and your SG&A expenses go up and down, that is called volatility. And that volatility, the more you have of it, the more chance you have of going below your interest payment, and therefore you're in default. It's sort of like, have you ever seen those pictures of those circus kind of rides out there in Las Vegas? There's one that's on top of a building. It's like a roller coaster. It's on top of the damn skyscraper. I mean, why you would want to, you know, I guess if you were constipated and you wanted to fix that, you'd ride something like that. Or have you ever been in an aerobatic plane? You know, one of those planes that does all the crazy maneuvers. Well, let me tell you this. It's really great when you're way, way up in the air, you know, like 5,000 feet, and you're doing these loop-de-loops and all that. It gets a lot scarier when you're down there at about 100 feet, because if there's a little bit of a miss, then you're essentially, you're what's called a debris field, and they clean you up with a shop vac. What I'm trying to get to here is, you get too close, that operating income gets too close to the interest you have to pay on your debt. Well, operating income is going to be volatile. It's going to go up and down from year to year and all that. You don't want that volatility to impact so greatly on operating income that you drop below your interest expense. And at 75%, at three-fourths of your company is debt, which means that you're paying a lot of interest, I would imagine. Well, that's a little scary, because you're getting awfully close to the ground to be doing fancy maneuvers or having volatility. And that's the subject of today's main lecture, is volatility. In other words, risk. But we'll get to that in just a little bit here. Okay, we've got that. And I've done times interest earned before. A couple of other ones that I do want to mention on your financial analysis formula sheet here. Okay, let me see if I can blow that up a little bit more. Average collection period, I'm not going to ask you about it. It's one that is kind of interesting. I look at it as sort of a secondary ratio. I'm not going to ask you about it on a quiz or an exam. But it's something just to kind of keep your eye on. Now, one over here on the asset activity, inventory turnover. In other words, how many times a year are your sales turning over your inventory? It's a mixed bag. Let me do it for the limited just for 2013. Okay, let's take the sales for 2013. Sales for 2013 are 10,459. 10,459. 459 divided by, now you go back over and look at your inventory. 1004 divided by 1004. So they rolled their inventory over 10.41 times. Now put that down. It's a times. It's not a percent. It's a times. In other words, their sales were such that they, on average, pulled their inventory. They actually restocked all their shelves, theoretically, more than 10 times. Now, here's the problem. Is that good or is that bad? Okay. If your inventory turnover ratio is very high, that means that your sales are going through your inventory very rapidly and you're bringing in more inventory. Okay, that was a management philosophy, management practice that got really huge in the 1990s. Learned it from the Japanese. It's called just-in-time. In other words, you actually hardly ever have any inventory before you've used it to finish a product and sell it. Just-in-time. So in other words, just-in-time has an incredibly high inventory ratio, turnover ratio. A lower inventory turnover ratio means that your inventory is sitting on your shelves for a longer period of time before it's moved off the shelves and sold. Okay, here's the upside and the downside. If you've got inventory sitting on your shelves, that's inventory that's not selling. So essentially, you have the opportunity cost of inventory that's just sitting there. So maybe you should keep less inventory and then just reorder more frequently, so that you're not having inventory just parked. There's another side to that I'll mention in a minute. However, on the other hand, if you have your inventory turning over extremely rapidly, that means that you're constantly ordering inventory because you have hardly enough in stock to cover a week or 2 weeks. Now, is there any problem with that kind of an inventory management system, just in time like that? Could you think of something that could go wrong? Yeah. Say that? Oh, what happens if there's a bottleneck? Well, we have enough inventory for a week. Boy, we don't need any warehouse space because we just reorder every week. Wait a minute, what do you mean we can't get our inventory this week? What do you mean there's snowstorms that can't get our stuff in? Uh-oh. You see, the problem is that if you're keeping inventory too thin, then you can get into a bottleneck, and then you're stocked out. And then here I am just sitting there. Yeah, I have 3 months of inventory, 4 months of inventory. Oh, there's a bottleneck? Well, I'll just order a little early. I've still got plenty to sell from the shelves. So the just-in-time can get you into a problem that way when you're reordering so fast and your inventory ratio is too high. Now, here's a deeper problem. The auto manufacturers, some of them in the United States, got totally into this Japanese just-in-time system, where basically the Japanese created these clusters of a car company would have its suppliers all around it, physically in an industrial park setting, so that when they needed a car door, they had the supplier get the car door ready, get it over to them. Essentially, there was never any inventory in the central auto company. Of course, you had to have extreme efficiency for this to work, and they were good at this. Americans have never been all that great at efficiency. That's not to say we're not okay. You know, I have no desire to be that damn efficient. But here was one of the things that happened, finally, with the U.S. auto industry. The factory started going to this just-in-time system. They told their suppliers, you're not our supplier anymore unless you move your facilities right here, right to our doorstep, so that we can do this Japanese thing with just-in-time. We'll call you when we need a bumper. You bring it over, blah, 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 all that. Well, when those car companies started cratering, every one of these companies around them, which had essentially turned itself into a full commitment supplier of this auto company in the center of the operation. So when the crater happened to the middle company, all of these other industrial companies around it just went right into the crater with it. They had given up all of their other things that they could have been doing. They had committed themselves to the physical space of these, and it was ugly. It magnified the auto industry collapse in the United States, and it turned it from sort of a microeconomic issue, an industry issue, into something that was considerably more. Cities were just, essentially like Detroit. They just went through the floor because when the central company died, you had acres and acres and acres of other companies that had turned into ghost town, into part of the ghost town. It's a cautionary tale. Other countries have great methods. We can learn from them. Don't think that we should completely embrace any other countries or any other industry's methods. We've got our own ways, and we should always be thinking about what if. And always remember the worst case scenario is the one that you should base yourself on. Minimize the maximum disaster that can happen in your setting. Okay, so that's enough lecture, but remember that when I'm to ask you some of my essay questions on exams. I might ask you, well, explain the difficulty with analyzing an inventory turnover ratio. And just give that in a short explanation. Too high, and you are actually in a situation where you could face a supply shortage through a bottleneck snowstorm, but if it's too low, then you've got inventory sitting on the shelves, and that's essentially taking up shelf space. Give you an interesting other side to that is in the company that I own. I produce artwork in frames, mats, and all of that, and then I set it on shelves for the spring and summer season. The problem is that unless I have that in a facility that's climate controlled, that means temperature and humidity, then it can get damaged in the winter months or even in the hot summer months. So in other words, I'm paying a lot more in storage fees because I build the inventory, and so my inventory turnover ratio is very low, and I'm costing myself a lot of money doing it that way. The alternative, unfortunately, is not very attractive either. Putting together things on the fly as I need them, that can be bad if someone calls up and says, we've got a show this weekend, we want you at it. Suddenly, I don't have anything to go to that show with. So there you go. Where was I? A price-to-earnings ratio. P-E ratio in the market values. Oh, as asset turnover. There's another one you can do. How many times over are your sales doing clearing your total assets out? Let me do that one real quick for the limited. I just want to bring it up to you. Your sales were $10,459 divided by the total assets in 2013, which were $6,019. And I get 1.74 times. That's a times two. After that one, you don't put a percentage, you put a times. In other words, this company, the Limited Brands, Inc., turned its total assets over in a theoretical kind of way. Obviously, they didn't turn the actual physical assets over. But they turned over the value of their assets to create sales 1.73 times. And again, here's the nuance. The lower that number is, the less you are actually making those assets work for you. I paid $1 million for you on a slave market. Okay, now, I have you working in a very difficult situation, but you earned me $1 million every year. So on a yearly basis, my return on you is actually not all that great, right? It would be greater if it would be better if I could, you know, every morning fill you up with some crystal meth and maybe put a cattle prod to you and some one of those energy drinks or something like that, and you could earn me $2 million every year. See, I'm flipping the asset, the value of the asset, over faster in the second situation, right? So the second situation is better, right? But not always. See, if I got you up to $2 million,
okay, crank her up. Let's put some more stuff into him. We got this experimental thing. And, oh boy, look at him, $3 million, okay? Okay, now let's add a little more juice to it, maybe two energy drinks a day, and a cup of coffee at coffee break time, and he's up to $4 million. And then we put in some more stuff and add a little more electricity to the cattle prod, and he's up to $5 million. $6 million with some more experimental medications and all of that, $8 million. What am I doing to him? What am I doing? I'm going to burn him out. He's going to essentially walk in someday and just detonate. Boom! Damn, that was a lot of money spent on him. Okay? So on the one hand, I don't want him being a low yield on the investment. But at the same time, I don't want to burn my assets out. When I see companies that have very high asset turnover ratios, I get really suspicious because we've seen this story before. Great example would be the U.S. refinery industry. You see, U.S. refineries, have any of you ever seen a refinery or one of those kinds of, with the giant cracking towers? They're actually in their own way totally gross, the smell and just the pollution that they're creating and, you know, turning the earth into a cinder over time with global warming. But at the same time, the first time I actually ever appreciated it, I was in Houston, near Houston. It was just hot as hell in the summer. The sun had just set, and I was looking out, and these crimson flares that were just incredibly high in the sky were burning in the wind, blowing along, just beautiful things. Those things had, the asset turnover ratio was phenomenal on those things. You're cracking that crude down, it goes up and it cracks into the different distillates and gasoline products and all of that. But one of the things about that was that they'd never spent any money upgrading those. Since the 1970s, there hadn't been a refinery built. All they were doing was just slapping parts on the old refineries and just keep running them. So their asset turnover ratio was phenomenal because the assets were depreciating in accounting terms and in economic terms. So the value of the assets was small. Sales off the assets were incredible. It's gasoline, distillates, diesel fuels, jet fuels, all those kinds of things. So you had these these asset turnover ratios that were just phenomenal year after year after year. But then we get to the 2000s. I don't know if you remember the time in the 2000s when there seemed like in the news every week or every month, another refinery exploded, 23 people killed, 12 people killed, another refinery blows up, sends parts flying across to Galveston and all that kind of stuff. That was what was happening. You were, over time, you were just wearing those assets out. Instead of providing proper maintenance for them, just to keep them productive, and also to provide for new technologies that were coming along and put those into service, all we did was just keep burning up the old refineries until they literally just blew up. And then, of course, well, we're going to have gasoline shortage. Gasoline prices went through the roof for a while, and then they'd come back down. Didn't learn. We have the same problem in other industries, especially in fossil fuels industries. One of the most surprising things I ever learned when I was doing consulting was when I stepped into the world of coal-fired electric generating plants. I was taken on a very serious tour. We went down, and the old engineer, he pointed, he said, look at this pipe. See this pipe, just iron pipe? All these pipes were all around. I was just, oh, this is awesome, man. This is complicated. He said, look at it. I didn't see. And then he finally said, look right here. Is that a swastika? Yeah. We bought these from the Nazis before we were enemies with the Nazis. You're telling me that this thing was built in the 20s, 30s? Yeah. And the same pipes that were there in the 20s and 30s are still there now? Yeah. The same thing. They just left. They didn't replace. They don't renew these things. They don't rebuild them from scratch. They just let them cruise until sooner or later when a coal-burning power plant blows up. It's kind of cool because the big pieces go through walls 20 miles away. The same thing, though. So don't be tempted to say, well, they're really doing great because they're really making those assets work. Well, that might be a warning sign that down the road, them assets aren't going to work anymore, and then that company doesn't have any sales at all because everything is shut down because all the workers are dead. This is lessons in real life for you who want to actually do this, to think about these numbers. Don't just do the numbers. Think about what they're saying to you. And I'm not going to go through any more. You can do the rest of them yourself. But do keep an eye on what it is that drives a company's numbers. Not just the numbers themselves, but what's the story behind the numbers. We know that certain ratios can't be certain things. But beyond that, you have to ask yourself, what is the industry averages for these ratios? And more important than that, what does my mind, my experience, my common sense tell me is going on here? Because sometimes even the industry, you look at the industry, the oil industry, the refinery asset turnover ratios, they were all about the same. Well, they're all in the same, so that must mean they're okay, this company I'm looking at. Well, that was just because they were all wrong. It's like, you know, did you see the movie Zombieland?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, obviously. You know, you had a lot of zombies. If you're a zombie, you look around me at all the other zombies, you say, oh, this, I'm cool because I look like all the other zombies. But you know damn well that you can't enjoy a Twinkie. Okay? So that means that you're not okay. You're not okay if you're a zombie, okay? So that just because all the industry average, the industry's numbers are about your numbers, that doesn't mean that your numbers are right. And besides which, if you're trying to be a leader, maybe just being like everyone else isn't the best idea to begin with anyway. More risk that way, though. And that's what we get to next. I'm going to bring this down for a minute here and turn up the house lights so that I can talk about some other things here for a while. This brings us to risk. Remember I told you the relationship between risk and return, the greater the risk you bear, the greater the return you must expect. If you are going to take risk and you have no expectation of a return on it, then you belong on YouTube or Jackass. You think about sometimes in real life, people do behave according to this risk-return relationship. It doesn't mean that you are going to get a return, but you expect something out of it. For example, I don't know if I mentioned, have any of you ever followed what's called the Darwin Awards? The Darwin Awards are these awards given out every year for the people who've done humanity the biggest favor by removing themselves from the gene pool so that their stupid genes don't spread to other people. Now, in this case, there was one, well, it's been about 10 years ago, that was kind of noteworthy. A group of guys were getting drunk, first problem, in West Virginia, problem two. And one of them had, a couple of them had actually explored an abandoned mine shaft and brought back what looked like a box of blasting caps, which are the precursor explosions that will send, make dynamite go really nice, or nitroglycerin. Problem three, you got drunken people in West Virginia with things that go boom. And so what they wanted to do was they wanted to try these blasting caps out, so they hooked them to a car battery and put a blasting cap, wired it, and put it into a giant aquarium. And they pushed it, they connected the alligator clip. Nothing happened. Checked it in. Nothing happened. And so they were actually trying to figure out, well, is the battery dead? No, the battery's kind of sparking. So one of them took a grabbed the blasting cap out of the aquarium, and he said, and here's problem four coming up, watch this. And he bit down on it, chomped it. Mm-hmm. Direct pressure on a blasting cap, you're not going to have Well, the sad thing is he couldn't win a Darwin Award because he actually lived through it. And he lost part of his jaw and all of his teeth, which just made him more attractive to women of the area. But here's the thing. Why would he do that? Why would he take that risk? He obviously expected something out of it. I'm not sure if he expected to make his lips turn into two long blankets, but so sometimes it's not money that's at stake when you bear a risk. Sometimes in our world, we have to turn it into the equivalent of money. But know this, that just because people take risks and you don't see a return or any expectation of a return, doesn't mean there's not possibly something going on. A lot of people take risks just because it increases their credibility with their friends. And if the risk doesn't work out, they're dead, so they don't care. So, but understand that risk we got to have a way to describe risk and to measure risk. Now, we have a couple of different numbers that we can calculate to get a handle on risk so that we can compare different risks. One of those would be the standard deviation. You've probably seen that thing in your statistics classes, and we're going to do that. We'll talk about standard deviations and all that. And there are other ones, too. In finance, one that's a little more important, and you'll have to tell me, in your stats class, were you introduced to the coefficient of variation? That's dividing by the mean. That standardizes so that we can look at companies and cash flows of different sizes, and they all come out apples to apples. So the coefficient of variation, CV, is one that we use. Another measure of risk, I mentioned before, is interest rates. They are measures of risk. I mean, if in order to induce someone to invest in a risky project, you've got to offer a darn nice interest rate on that investment. Otherwise, people are going to say FTS. Fancy that scenario. They're not going to invest. So interest rates are a measure of risk. And then there's a specialized one in investment finance called beta, which is a very cool single number that's like sort of like our little gold standard. We always look at that as sort of a thumbnail snapshot of risk. But anyway, the thing is, if, woman, you run a trucking company. Your name is Betty, and you're the boss. Well, Betty, she's our boss. She says, we got to get this delivery over to Topeka by midnight. And Betty, what Betty wants, Betty gets. So, well, we do one run. She charges, she sets up the bills and billing and profit, figures the revenues, the costs and all that, gets down to the bottom line. Well, one run, gas prices are pretty darn attractive, down at about $3.12 a gallon. Well, a month later, she tells us we got to do another run. And at that point, gasoline prices are $3.96 a gallon. Okay, you see that the gasoline price is volatile. Now, Betty, what kind of a company do you run? It's a trucking company, right? Your business, your core model, your core business is delivering goods and services. Your core business is not... You see, when the gas price was low, she's going to make more money. When the gas price is high, she's not going to make as much money. So gasoline prices are causing profit volatility. But you're not in the business of gasoline prices, speculating on when deliveries should be made and all that. You're in the business of delivering goods because your name is Betty and you're the boss of the delivery company. See, there's that thing that we have to deal with. When we're in business, we're going to have what are called exposures of all kinds. And exposures, some of them, that's what we do. That's why we are paid, because we take those exposures and we charge a fair price or an unfair price so that we can to bear that exposure. But there are other exposures that we face We don't want those. We don't want to profit or lose. We don't celebrate when gas prices go down. We made more money because the next week prices are going to go up on gas and we're going to lose money. So we don't celebrate all risk. The risks that we want that are the core of our business, why we charge money for what we do, yeah, we take those. But we also take risks that we don't want to. And a large part of finance and insurance is dealing with those risks. How do we handle risks that we don't want? How do we manage the risk structure of our investments? How do we manage the risk of our lives? I'm going to tell you, I might have already mentioned this at some point in the game here. Woman, you're going to die someday. Mm-hmm. It will hurt like hell, probably. And you'll bitch and you'll moan. You'll scream. You'll say, I want more of life. I want more of everything in life. I'm not too young to die. And someone will say, well, someone please pull the plug and I accidentally trip over and you shut up. And you're dead. But you see the problem. Wait, what? What the hell was that about? You're looking at... But you see, I don't know when you're going to die. You could die in 100 years. Mm-hmm. Or you could walk out of this building and get hit by a truck. Ding, 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 ding. Okay. You know, in the latter case, all your friends will be dead by then, so no one will care. And in the earlier case, we're going to have to get a spatula. And but I'm going to tell you about your life. I want to describe your life to you right here and now. And you don't have to thank me. You know, here's the timeline. And here are your health care costs. Now, you were born, and you know, you were a relatively small baby, so it wasn't too bad. And you were fairly healthy, so there was some cost involved. And then in your early years, in your infant years, you were having the problems. You know, you had the shits a couple of times and all that kind of stuff. But you got a little more into your toddler years, and you were, God, we just couldn't keep you out of things. And there was that incident with the drinking the Windex, and then there was that thing with Daddy's power tools that was, thank God they sewed your fingers back on. But and then you got into later years. You were a fairly healthy girl. And, you know, we got you. And then things got a little bit trickier around 11, 12. And then there was that really, really bad acne. I mean, that stuff was bad. Oh, sorry. And then we got you through that. And then there was that incident where you were dating the crack dealer and there was that shootout and we had to get a doctor, pay a doctor extra money to pull the bullet out of you. But you got into your later teen years. And this is a good time. Do you have a memory when you were young of vomiting your guts out and being sick and having snot and sore throats? More than you do these days, you're beginning to get into that herd, that immune period. You've gotten through all the crap. You're developing a herd immunity to a lot of the things that kids get. And you've got enough vaccinations that'll make you autistic someday. No, that's not true. Yes, it is. No, it is. You're getting into a healthier period of your lives right now, and you're going to feel at the top of the world, and you're really not going to have, and you're typical of this time period in your life, you're going to have the little things that happen, and well, once in a while there's going to be something that bothers you. But you're pretty healthy on a yearly basis. I mean, there's just, you know, typical things, but then you get into your early 40s, your cholesterol is starting to bother you, And then there's that diabetes. Well, you get through that. Then you have your first cancer, your second cancer, your third one. We get you through all those. Of course, you've got all those medicines you take now. And then you've got that hip joint replacement, about 60. And then the other hip is replaced. And then they take both those out because those didn't work. And then you've got another cancer. And now you've got nodules. And you got your diabetes is really bothering you. And at about the age of 90, you die. Your life. Well, now, here is the part that's kind of sad, though. Because your income is supported by your parents in your early years, and then you're a loser after college for a while. But finally, you begin to recover, and your income is on this really nice growth path. Oh, shoot. You're out. You're done right here. Game over. In game theory, this is called gambler's ruin. Your house is taken away. They shoot your dogs. They make you sell parts of your body for low prices to wealthy people in the Middle East. Oh, man, once your income goes, I mean, you're basically on Social Security, which means that you're getting enough to buy cat food. How can you pay for all these meds? And Medicare has been canceled because libertarians took over and they don't believe in helping people. You're done. Game over. Back there, even before you had a chance to finish your productive life. See, in this area, your productive life is still underway, but that's the end of the game. The end of the game. Okay, now, we're going to do your life. You were a sickly baby. I mean, you come out of the womb and you are already bitching. You already got physical problems and all this, but, you know, actually, those problems got you kind of to the point where you were a very quiet kid. I mean, after you've nearly died a few times and seen the light and seen relatives that you didn't know you had, I mean, that makes you a very, very tame little boy. And you stay pretty quiet. Although there are the usual childhood illnesses, you have them a little later because you went through puberty at 23. But you're fairly healthy. But you start getting your beer belly, high cholesterol, your first heart attack at 30, your second heart attack, and then there's obviously, you start getting healthy, you start exercising, you're starting to feel okay, but then you have to start buying Viagra for what I have no idea because no woman wants you. And then you got and you take so much of it that you've got prostate problems. And then you don't have diabetes. You get you're fairly healthy, though, but, you know, you're still having your problems. But, of course, you die before she does. That's the way it works. Men die earlier, which is okay because then we don't have to listen to our wives anymore. Notice something interesting about what's going on here. Different people have different expenditure spikes and expenditure troughs in their health insurance. And if you look, these are actually kind of canceling each other out along the way. If you put enough of these together that are not perfectly correlated, you put hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of people together, and what will eventually happen is that you will see something that is actually a principle of the universe. And it happens all over the place. They create a hum. Just a single cost per year of the overall insured pool of people. Those costs that spike for you, they wouldn't be spiking at the same time for you, not for you. You put enough of them together and the spikes and troughs smooth each other out, and suddenly there's no longer that risk in insuring you. There's no longer that risk in insuring you. Because over all the people we insure, we know that it's going to be the same payout every year, just different to different people. That is the principle of insurance. It's also a principle in finance, and I'll get to that in a minute. But understand that there is a hum here, and that's what actuarial science is all about, is figuring out what is that pool cost per year. And then we can add a little bump to it for profit for the insurance company to do this kind of coverage and charge that to all of you. And then when you cross this spike here, you're not ruined because you are in the insurance pool. That's the principle of insurance. Now, there are problems with this because, and as we're seeing with the Affordable Care Act, young people will tend to avoid, they won't care about the health insurance, because they see themselves, well, I'm paying more in this premium. I don't go to the doctor. Why should I pay for this mom and dad and their snot-nosed kids to take their kids to the doctor every time the kid has a cold? So you have that adverse selection. The people who need the indemnification more are more likely to seek the indemnification. That is adverse selection. You also have problems, that's a big problem. You also tend to have another problem called moral hazard. Because if you are insured, you will tend to take more risks than you when if you are not insured. So that once you are covered, you know you've got insurance. So what are you going to do? You're going to go out snowboarding at the Olympics. Have you seen the snowboarders? It's pretty cool. They make snowballs because they made the slope too steep. Or you're going to go out kayaking in a storm off the ocean. You will tend to take more risks. Some of those, you do it deliberately. Some of them, you just do it unconsciously. Some of them, because you are seeing that the main risk is avoided, you tend to embrace other risks that you don't have any idea or are there, or you misassess. That was one of the problems with birth control pills, was that they allowed for what we call the sexual revolution, because the risk of pregnancy dropped down. That's a big one, you know, for guys, you know, really. Advice, don't say whose is it, okay? That's bad, okay? But here's the deal. You saw no risk, you know, birth control. However, you didn't see the risk of sexually transmitted diseases. And finally, we got burned with some really nasty ones late 70s, 80s. So that's that moral hazard. You don't really know you're taking on risks, but you are. The same with, you know, health insurance. Well, I'm insured. I can do this. I'm not afraid of this. Well, you should have been afraid of that because you embraced it and there were all these other risks that were attendant to that higher risk behavior that you did. The same is true with auto insurance too. We tend to ignore risks because we're insured. I've seen some of you take risks that, so help me God, I've got a rocket-propelled grenade. I'm going to take you out someday if you cut me off like that again. But so there are these difficulties. And on the insurer's side, there are some issues too. One of them is called cherry picking. Cherry picking is because insurance companies, some of them, try to get only the pools that are already known actuarially to be low risk. And then they leave everyone else in a higher risk category seeking insurance through maybe even the substandard markets. Another nasty practice, it was in insurance and it's in real estate. It's still being done, even though there are laws trying to stop it. It's called redlining. Have you ever heard of redlining? Redlining in real estate is where you actually make sure that people of specific races are not shown houses in places that are ethnically different from theirs. In insurance, you still see redlining to this day. There have been some studies that have shown that There are companies that just avoid African-American men because they have higher risk of heart attacks, or they avoid women, or they avoid people over the age of 50. So cherry picking and redlining kind of go hand in hand as dirty stories on the insurance side of the equation. Take those out of it, though. Take those out of it. And there really is this thing that we can achieve by putting more and more risk agents into the pool. And that's true in, but of course the whole bottom line though is that you don't want them to be perfectly correlated, because then you're not reducing risk. You want them to have a randomness against each other. And then you get this very cool phenomenon that after you have put enough of them together, there's this hum of risk that is much better manageable, much more manageable. In investments, this is the way it works. Because you see, if I buy one stock, and I have that for my portfolio, I can promise you that stocks are highly volatile. They go up and down like you're in a rodeo on a very angry bull. They just go up and down. There's extraordinary volatility. Understand this, though, that if I got two stocks and held them together, as long as they're not perfectly correlated, some of that individual volatility would cancel out. Some would still be there. I put three stocks that are not perfectly correlated, and more of it goes away. 5, 10. Ultimately, and this is what, how can you use an entire acetate? God, that pisses me off. Anyway, okay, I'll just put it up here. Ultimately, if I am measuring risk on this axis, and I'm just going to say risk for now, on the vertical axis, risk, holding one stock, I have this incredible amount of volatility. Day to day, the price is going to go up and down and up and down, whipsaw. If I put two stocks in the portfolio, some of that volatility disappears because the overall price of the two stocks together, their value, is still going to be going up and down, but it's not going to have as much volatility, risk. Put three, even more of the individual volatilities cancel out. 4, 10, 20, 30. You get what we call an asymptotic reduction of risk. But the asymptote is not zero, of course. There is, just like always, just like in anything else in the universe, an underlying hum. That is what is called market-related risk. If you held every stock in its in proportion to that company's weight in the economy, overall market portfolio. In other words, you have a proportional weighted portfolio of every stock, you would achieve this underlying volatility. But of course, that's kind of ridiculous. You're not going to do that. But here's the thing. You get a portfolio of 30 stocks, you've gotten rid of 95% of the market of the volatility of the individual stocks. You are at 30 stocks, you have essentially 95% of a market portfolio. And you know, you can get more. Yeah. Oh, you beat me to it. Darn it. Yeah, as a matter of fact, mutual funds are a way, the mutual fund has this massive buying power. They buy huge numbers of stocks, tailored to people's different risk desires. You know, they'll buy a massive pile of risky stocks, massive pile of safe stocks, maybe a massive pile of international stocks. They'll offer you different funds. And then you just buy into the mutual fund and you buy into insanely great risk reduction. You're basically at the scale of those things with all their stocks. You've got market portfolio. Just leverage in or out according to your risk preferences. There's another instrument out there now, too, called an ETF. Have any of you ever run into those? They are, okay, here's the upside of a mutual fund. You can get low load or no load mutual funds, get into those, and you just join the fund and you're in it. You just put in money, you can put in money of your own, you know, every month commit $100 to it. You can do it through your employer. Some employer retirement plans or savings plans allow you to do it. And you just ride them along. The problem with a mutual fund is that, let's say that you're in a mutual fund that has a relatively high risk profile, and you are getting to a point where, well, I'm a little worried about our economy. I might want to shift down to something that's a little bit less volatile, less sensitive to economic times. Well, you can do that only 4 times a year. You have only these windows. You can't just trade it whenever you want. Switch it. What usually a lot of people do, and which I recommend this, is you buy a couple of different mutual funds. Like, for example, you might go 30% bonds, 70% stocks, and then over time, if you feel like you want to take more risk, the economy is growing, I might move towards the stock, go to 80% stocks, 20% bonds. If I want to pull back and get it more defensive, I might pull maybe 50-50 or even 60-40, something like that. Okay? But know this, they're great, but you are not, this is not for an active trader. Not for an active trader. And you don't have to pay a fee or anything like that. It's for the no loads, and you've got all this volatility that's shaken out. You do not have this diversifiable risk. See this risk right here? That is what we call diversifiable risk. The other term for it is that it is non-systematic. It's not in the system. It's in the stocks. Non-systematic risk. That's risk that you don't need to take. And if you don't need to take it, you have no business expecting a reward for it. The market is not going to reward you. You should not expect a reward for the diversifiable risk. Because you can get rid of that, and if you don't get rid of it, you're stupid. And you deserve to lose your money to someone who's not stupid. So when you hear I get email messages all the time. Well, I'm looking at this stock. What do you think? Should I put maybe a couple of grand or one young man, 10 grand into a stock? Are you on crack? No. What the heck? Why would you buy a single stock? You're buying a mass of diversifiable risk. You're never going to get rewarded for that. And you're going to hear, well, I heard about a guy I saw on TV. He invested in one stock and he made himself $100 million. Uh-huh. Well, you know how many millions of people did exactly that kind of investment strategy and they lost their asses? You're not going to hear about them on investment show. Ha, I invested in one stock and I lost my ass. You're not going to hear them talking about. All you're ever going to hear is a few lucky SOBs that actually win doing that kind of thing. You know, there are people who actually make money, make $100 million buying lottery tickets. You ain't going to be one of them. You're going to be one of those millions and millions of people who buy them every week who are so stupid they don't grasp that they're never going to make the $100 million in the lotto. Whatever. Okay, now, mutual funds, no fees, but you have limited trading ability. There's another animal out there called an ETF, an electronically traded fund. They actually are stocks that you can buy just like any other stock, except these stocks are actually a compilation of an index. Like, you could buy one of these ETFs. So it's a stock, and it is the Standard & Poor's 500 index. You are investing in 500 companies, literally, by buying this one stock, the ETF. The cool part, of course, is you get super diversification. You also, there's stocks. You can buy them and sell them. You can get up in the middle of the night and call your broker. Hi, broker. What the hell are you doing calling me at the... I need you to buy me one share of... You're not going to do that. You're going to... But at the same time, they have that just perfectly tradable. You don't have to wait for your window. You can buy and sell. You can do limit orders on them. You can do the whole nine yards, just like any other stock. But the downside of that, of course, is that you pay your brokerage fee every time you do it. So it's not like the mutual funds where there's no fee to join, no fee to change. You're going to pay whenever you want to shift your portfolio. Like one day, one night, you're sleeping, and then all of a sudden, the Lord himself comes to you. I'm the Lord. Sell the Standard & Poor's 500 and buy the Dow 50 or the Dow 30. This is the word of the Lord. And I disappear back in the night. So you've got to call your broker right away. I mean, if you got a mutual fund, you tell the mutual fund manager, the Lord called me last night. I just got to change here. Well, he's not going to do anything for you. But if you got ETFs, you can just do it like a boss. God told me to do this. Execute that trade. Okay? You see the difference. But you're going to have to pay for it. It's because it's just, you know, anytime you buy or sell stock, you pay that transaction fee. So it's like, which one would you choose to go with? Honestly, the whole idea of doing active trading in stocks is kind of like a myth, because for the most part, all you're doing is making yourself, giving yourself a headache. Shifting your portfolio should be something that you don't do that often anyway. When you change your life, the day you get married, you probably would want to shift your portfolio. The day you have your 13th child, the day you buy that dream double-wide trailer, the day you retire, major thing. Or the day you look out the window and there's zombies coming at you. That's a sell signal, okay? Yeah, if you have good reason to believe that the economic times are turning on you, don't fight the herd. Have you ever fought a herd? No, sir. Trust me, it's not worth it. The herd will win, and you will be a trophy on the horns of one of the cows in the herd. Okay? You understand? Unless you are absolutely a genius at investing, then it's better to just do the buy and hold. And that probably would point you toward the mutual funds, but not necessarily. If you're just going to buy ETFs and hold them like you would in a mutual fund, they are super cool, and you can do a lot of cool refinements and set up really cool portfolios. So either one, not for so much for your chance to trade, but for what your tailored needs are. We'll finish this up on Thursday. That's all I have for you. Thank you.